1986 Theological Institute, Dr. Robert Newman.
Our subject this morning is Romans chapters 1 and 2, and we've entitled it Evidence for God in Cosmos and Conscience, or more briefly, God in Cosmos and Conscience. There are some ways in which the Greco-Roman world of the first century AD is very, very different from our own society. And there are some ways in which it's very similar, very different. They didn't have radios. They didn't have automobiles. They didn't have airplanes. Okay, technology, very, very different, though perhaps not quite as different as you might imagine. You may very well have grown up in a home, or your grandparents grew up in a home where there was no running water. Many of the people of the Greco-Roman period had running water. Their public baths were quite snazzy compared to any kind of bath system that we have got, and my impression is that at least in the wealthier cities, these public baths were free to whoever was involved there. Ancient society, ancient Greco-Roman society, was also more religious than modern secular society is, although it would be a mistake to make a huge difference between the two ideas. There certainly were atheists around at that time, although they were probably somewhat rarer than they are today. There were no ideologies controlling large sections of the world that were atheistic, as there are today. So I think it's fair to say that theoretical atheism was rarer then than it is now. On the other hand, practical atheism has always been an extremely common position. That is a position that does lip service to some kind of religion, but in fact the people live as though God doesn't exist. They are not concerned about God at all in their life, except to the extent that the god or gods or whatever powers there might be out there don't mess them up too much. And so they'll go to some trouble to straighten things out. Astrology takes a little bit of that flavor today and back then as well. What's astrology for? It's to tell you whether you ought to stay in bed or whether you can go out and safely do something or another. And who cares whether it really comes from who or that, etc. I just want to get through life safest possible and such. The letter to the Romans, as Paul starts out his discussion of what the gospel is, he starts out with what's wrong with man. And one of the drastic things wrong with man is that many, many men live as though there is no God. And so as Paul opens his section on what I've called human guilt before God, we can divide that up into two parts. And most everybody, I think, divides it into these two parts. But the label here is Francis Schaeffer's label, which gives us a hint on how this applies to modern society. He calls the two parts human guilt before God, man without the Bible, and man with the Bible. Actually, in the historical situation at New Testament times, as you know from Dr. Peterson's remarks, it is actually the guilt of the pagans, the guilt of the Gentiles, the guilt of those whose connection with special revelation is at most very remote, perhaps centuries before somebody in their race knew something directly about God from special revelation, perhaps from at the time of the ark or a few generations beyond there, but it's become very, very corrupted after that time. And he will deal in chapter 1, verse 18 through 2:16 with people of this particular sort. And then in 2:17 and following, he will deal with the Jews, those who had had special revelation coming to them all the way up until about 400 years before this, and then resumed again with the coming of John the Baptist and the ministry of Jesus and the apostles and such, and pointing to them what God had said in special revelation. Our concern here in the title God in Cosmos and Conscience is to look at the fact that the Bible says quite explicitly there is evidence for the God who really exists, the God of the Bible, the God who made all things, even if you don't have the Bible, even if you don't know about the Bible. There are two lines of evidence for the existence of God. There's evidence for God in what we call the cosmos. We shouldn't make that too astronomical sounding at this particular point. And an external testimony to the existence of God. And there's evidence for God in the existence of a conscience, an internal testimony to the existence of God. We want to look and see what Paul has to say about these particular subjects. We'll stray some from what he has to say in a few places, because I think certain things have happened technologically since Paul's time that allow us to say some things about the cosmos that Paul personally did not know about. but God certainly knew about, and God is the one who guided Paul in the wording of the letter to the Romans, and therefore makes it applicable for our time as well. Just before our section starts, we have these two verses which in a way introduce most of the book after finishing the introductory section, verses 16 and 17. Paul, having said that he's eager to preach the gospel to you in Rome, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. I'm not ashamed of this good news, because it is the power of God for salvation to all who believe, to the Jews first and also to the Greeks. And then he's going to begin to discuss Jews and Greeks through this period, through this section, and their relationship to God's good news. In it, a righteousness from God is revealed, that we need God's righteousness, not our righteousness, to be able to stand in the judgment. It's revealed from faith to faith. Perhaps a righteousness from God is revealed, which is faith first to last. Perhaps that's a way of paraphrasing it. Just as it is written, he alludes to Hosea chapter 2, verse 4, the just, the righteous one, shall live by faith. Then he begins in verse 18 and runs on into the next chapter, and actually runs on into chapter 3, of showing that everyone is guilty before God, whether he be Gentile, that's who he starts with, or whether he be Jew. He starts here with the Gentile rather than to the Jew first, as he does in several other passages, because what the Gentiles know about God is from general revelation, the revelation of the cosmos itself, the revelation of conscience itself. And, of course, the Jews have that source available to them as well. Then he's going to move on to the Jews, who have an additional source available to them, which at this point in salvation history, not too many Gentiles knew much about. Obviously, some Gentiles who are hearing the gospel do, but most of those who are not connected with it do not. I've divided up the rest of my talk, then, into the statement in verse 18 of man's responsibility, and then verses 19 and 20 seem to me to point to evidence from the cosmos for the existence of the God of the Bible, and then a little more scattered in 132, 21, 214, and 15, though the context is all related to this question, evidence for God from the conscience. So, Lord willing, those are the two things we'd like to have a look at. Notice what verse 18 has to say then, following immediately on Paul's remarks that he is not ashamed of the gospel, it's the righteousness of God, etc. He says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven upon all the impiety and unrighteousness of mankind who suppress the truth in righteousness. So basically, Paul is saying here, God is angry with mankind, men and women. Why? Because of their impiety, their ignoring God, and their unrighteousness, their positive acts of sinfulness. And he charges them with playing with the truth, misusing the tools which God has given men to be able to discern the truth. And so he says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They don't want it to come out a certain way. And so by an unrighteous application of the means which we've been given by God to discern what things are true and what are not, men have been able to avoid certain conclusions. So here man's responsibility is laid out very strongly. The problem which man faces, the bad news before the good news, is there something drastically wrong with man's relationship to God. And it goes back, at least first of all, to man's unwillingness to recognize the God who actually exists. Then in verse 19, he begins to justify his claim that God is angry with men because of their impiety, and that these men are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. Notice what he says, because God's wrath is revealed, etc., because that which may be known of God is plainly to be seen either in them or among them. The Greek there is ambiguous, can be taken either way. That which may be known of God is plainly to be seen in them or among them, for God has revealed it to them. So he now clarifies a little bit. Why is God angry with men who are suppressing the truth? because there are certain things that may be known about God. They are sufficiently plain that Paul can call them plain. He calls them it revealed. He doesn't tell whether it's revealed in them, interior revelation, or among them. And we'll see from a remark here that probably he has both in mind eventually. He's going to deal first with the among in verse 19 and 20. And then it seems to me he will deal with the in them, the conscience idea, further on. So that which may be known of God, he doesn't say how much that is, plainly to be seen among them, God has revealed it to them. And then verse 20, he begins to elaborate that even a bit more. For the invisible things, or perhaps certain invisible things about him, I would say, is probably the way to translate the genitive there. Certain invisible things about him are perceived from the creation of the world. Either have been perceived as long as there's been a world around, or perceived from the object, the world itself, here viewed as creation. So he's certainly going to go in that other way in the last part of his remarks here. The invisible things about him are perceived from the creation of the world, being understood, I would take here, by the things that are made, namely his eternal power and divine nature, so that they are without excuse. Notice he comes back again. They are without excuse. So God's angry, verse 18, they're suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, but it's sufficiently plain that they are without excuse for suppressing the truth. They are without excuse for knowing certain things about God's invisible nature from certain visible things. And that's basically how he goes here. I suggest then that the evidence of God from the cosmos consists of certain of God's invisible attributes. And I sketch them here for you then, right under our heading, evidence from the cosmos. Two words, divine nature, perhaps deity, divinity, something like that would be adequate for that word, and his eternal power. So, something about God that distinguishes him from all that is not God is visible in what has been made. And that involves, one thing at least that is involved in that is the eternality of God's power. That he's apparently the one who has eternal power. So we suggest God's invisible attributes are what is evidenced, if you like, from the cosmos. And then I suggest that the Bible is rather definite that these things aren't just a matter of a toss-up, that you really can't tell. And if you like religion, well, you can believe in a God. If you don't like religion, you really don't need to believe in God. God's picture of the matter is rather that these things are revealed, first of all. That's one of the words he uses here. And that's the idea of uncovering something. Something that might not otherwise be obvious is made obvious. They are perceived. The idea here has the idea of man's mind grasping hold of what's there. They're plainly seen, and whatever we make out of that, we've got to read that with the whole remark about suppressing and about being without excuse. The evidence of God and his cosmos is sufficiently clear that men are without excuse if they don't come to that conclusion. That seems to be the point there. Revealed, perceived, plainly seen, understood, and men are without excuse for not coming to it, but obviously some of them don't. And the reason, God says, is that they have suppressed the truth. They have methodologically mishandled the information. They wouldn't handle information that way if it weren't a question with this kind of stakes. But since it is, and since they don't want that answer, that's what they're going to do. Well, so we've got what is revealed, God's invisible attributes. How revealed is it, you might ask? Plain. Sufficiently plain for men to be judged. And how is it revealed? In or by means of the things that are made. That's basically what our passage says here. The invisible things about him are perceived from the creation of the world, being understood by the things that are made. And then these invisible things are his eternal power and divine nature. We're not told in this passage exactly how these things are understood, except by the phrase, the things that are made. There are a few hints elsewhere, though. Think of Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament displays his handiwork. That gives us, I think, a little fill-in of what Paul has in mind here in this particular passage. At least one thing about the divine attributes of God can be seen from the heavens. Now, that's not to rule out the possibility they can also be seen from the earth and from the animals and the flowers and such. But one place you can see it is the heavens. And the passage in Psalms 1, talking in terms of revelation, says the heavens are telling us something. In fact, that's the way the hymn goes. The heavens are telling, okay? The heavens declare what's the glory of God. Well, that can mean several things. Might mean something bright and shining, and the author may have chosen that particular term because he's thinking in terms of the sun, the moon, and such. But the Hebrew word here actually means that which makes God distinct from other beings, that which makes God important. It's actually a word that's very closely related to the weight of God. We still talk about a weighty matter, that sort of thing. So the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies, is here at the NIV's representation, it's actually the term we have usually given, firmament. It's something up there, the atmosphere, the sky, proclaims the work of his hands. That last remark is a little bit of a hint of what the means of this argument from Cosmos is apparently going to involve. The word handiwork fits in very nicely with the remark in Romans, the things that are made. How do you tell a good artist from a bad artist? Well, do you look at what they look like? No, a good artist might be handsome, and a bad artist might be ugly. In fact, the artist may not have much choice over that. Although within a certain range, all of us can make ourselves look better than we would otherwise or worse than we would otherwise. You know, there's a little range there, but to a certain extent, you've got what you've got, and you can't do too much about it. You don't look at the artist. You don't listen to what they talk about. There are people who can talk brilliantly about art, but they aren't artists. One artist, well-known one, though I have no memory now who it was once asked, what do you artists talk about when you get together? And his answer was, well, we talk about where you can get the best turpentine. So, interested in the technical matters of oil painting, etc. So, same thing may be true with musicians as well. There may be people who can speak very learnedly about music, but they're not musicians. How do you tell a good artist from a bad artist? You look at the work they've done, okay? How do you tell a good carpenter from a bad carpenter? Well, if bad carpenters bend the nail over in the middle, they pull it out again, put in another one so that their work doesn't look bad. They try not to use warped wood if they can avoid it. Sometimes a contractor overrules in these matters and such. But the way you tell a good workman from a bad workman is by his work. So some kind of an analogy is lurking here in these two remarks. I think we see that develop more thoroughly in Acts 17, where Paul is talking to the educated Greeks at the Areopagus, Mars Hill, in Athens. And if you look at that passage, we're not going to work our way through that passage. We're trying to stick to Romans 1 and 2. It seems that Paul's argument is, man is God-made, not God is man-made. Okay, a lot of the atheists want to tell you, God is man-made. But the Bible's remark is, no, man is God-made. Brings us back to a rather clever remark of C.S. Lewis in his allegory, I guess we better call it, Pilgrim's Regress. He, in shooting down a huge giant who represents Freudianism, one of the stumping questions is, how do you tell an original from a copy? And the giant can't answer that. And it's the whole sort of thing of explaining away the existence of God by saying God is just a projection of your father. And Christianity says, no, your father is just a small model of God, and maybe a very bad one or a rather good one, depending on what kind of father you happen to have had. So that, I think, is what we see going on as the argument here. God's invisible attributes, namely his divine nature and eternal power, are revealed clearly enough to hold men responsible by the things that are made, and the means in which this functions is through observation of the cosmos itself. Suggests a master designer, suggests a designer, does not suggest something that happened by itself. I mention here, somewhat aside, a rather nice work by Dorothy Sayers, You may know her from writing mystery stories or perhaps from translating Dante's Divine Comedy into English. Excellent playwright, has written a work called The Mind of the Maker, in which she, as a maker of literature, compares how things you learn about writing good literature can tell you something about what God is like. And I would suggest that the same thing can be true of what a carpenter does. Things that a carpenter does, who's a good carpenter, can tell that person and others something about what God is like. And we could go on and generalize that to many other kinds of makers. Not much is given us in the way of details in this particular passage, but that the heavens, from the Psalm passage, and here the things that are made, tell us something about God sufficiently clearly that men are without excuse. My suggestion is that God has intentionally left the details open because things are going to change in regard to what we know about the cosmos rather drastically between Paul's time and our own, and should the Lord tarry perhaps even more drastically in the next 200 or 300 years. We don't know whether the Lord will be back before then. I kind of suspect he will, but there are doubtless people living in 1000 AD who kind of suspected he would too, and were wrong. That God has not given us exact information about the time of the Lord's second coming. So my suggestion here is probably the details have been left open so that men can rethink this whole question in terms of each generation's knowledge and technology. I am not, therefore, going to give us a tour of what was known in antiquity about mankind and life and all of these things, and in what was known in the Middle Ages and what was known at the Renaissance and such. For one thing, I don't have enough background for that. You need a historian of science for that, and I've had some science work, but not in history of science. I would say this, that even in antiquity, the marvelous nature of mankind, you remember the remark of the psalmist, fearfully and wonderfully made is the phrase he uses. You'll find similar remarks like that among the Greeks, the philosophers and such. It was fairly obvious to ancient men that the best thing they could make weren't in a league with the natural things actually existing. That nobody could make any, people could make things, fine artists could make things that looked like men and women, but they couldn't do the things that men and women could. And so even in antiquity, the marvelous nature of mankind, of life, of the environment and such were realized. The Acts 14 passage back there under how, Acts 14:17, God gives rain and crops and food and joy, picks up the sort of idea that God has got a rather marvelous environment that he has made for us. And we've begun to find out in this century it's a very, very rare environment as well. I'll come back to that in a moment. But just to point out here that even in antiquity, the marvelous nature of mankind, life, and the environment was realized, and it did not look like a work of chance. And so it was a rare idea in antiquity that there was no God, that nothing, that this stuff had just happened by chance. It wasn't an unheard of idea. The Epicureans believed that things were a result, even the gods were a result of chance, but it was a rare idea. And it was held, it seems to me, in rather small groups of people who were really somewhat less familiar with how complicated nature really was, because they weren't out there doing much in it. They were sitting around in their cities and taking baths and having their slaves do all the work for them. And although that gives them more time for intellectual studies, you can sometimes get very isolated from what the world is really like in those kind of areas. In Darwin's time, there was a great attempt to dilute this particular kind of idea. I do not know to what extent it was in Darwin's own mind when he put together the theory of evolution, but within a generation of Darwin's time, it was felt that the argument from design in nature was dead. You find in the Bridgewater treatises in the 1830s a number of Christians who were scientists writing articles about the great evidence of design in nature. And then with the publication of Origin of Species in 1859 and its influence in the next couple of decades, many, many people came to believe what you think is design in nature isn't design in nature. It's only the survival of the accidentally better fitting types of plants and animals. And over the course of many generations, you get things that fit very well and it looks like they are designed. Not everybody went over to that view, of course, but you're certainly aware that evolution basically swept modern educated society to the point where, until the rise of the creationist movement here in recent years, most intellectuals would feel that only snake handlers were believers in evolution, and that anybody who was at all sophisticated in their religion believed that God was the great evolutionist at most, and that what do you need God for anyway? We can see a mechanism by which all these things can happen. However, some things of rather considerable interest have begun to happen in the last few years, and I give you about a sentence on it right down here at the bottom of our remarks. I'll make a few more remarks on it. In the area of cosmology, it's become more and more apparent in this century that this universe doesn't look like a universe that's always been here. It looks like a universe that something very drastically happened back some time ago. The scientists in general feel that we're talking 10 to 20 billion years back in the past. I'm not about, in a course on Romans 1 and 2, to get into the age of the earth question. If you'd like to ask me about it, you may at some later time. But what has been called the Big Bang, the universe was once very highly compressed and very hot and such, and it has been expanding from that point. That does not sound enough like Genesis to many people to feel great comfort in it, and yet it is a universe with a beginning, and attempts to make it into a universe that didn't have a beginning, which the universe was collapsing, this hot gas form, before it expands from it, have been many, and they have run across a number of very serious problems. Probably a nice popular discussion of this whole area is a book by a person who's not a Christian, Robert Jastrow, his book God and the Astronomers, in which he points out, yes, the evidence now looks pretty strong for a universe with a beginning, and an awful lot of astronomers, physicists, and cosmologists don't like it. And then he says, and why is that? He says, though he is an astronomer and a physicist, he says it's because we like to have a study area where we're going to be able to explain everything. And if it turns out there's a God behind things, we won't be able to explain everything. And so he ends his book with a rather notable example, a notable sort of parable that's been quoted rather widely. Here is the astronomer climbing hand over hand up the mountain of knowledge, and he reaches the top and sees a bunch of theologians sitting there on top. Known all the time, the Bible was God really made it all. I wrote him a note after that and said that he'd actually oversimplified the theological situation and ignored theological liberalism, where several theologians had climbed down the mountain and denied there was any top. But in any case, that's the way he ends that. As far as I know, Robert Jastrow would be an example of a person who, at least last I heard, was agnostic, but who believed that the evidence pointed towards a universe with a beginning, and therefore some kind of a beginner. A more striking example comes from the whole question of the origin of life. 50 years ago, 40 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago, many people who were into the whole area of biochemistry and such tended to think of life as not too complicated. You've got some kind of, we're thinking of the simplest cell as maybe the simplest form of life, and it's some kind of a bag with some kind of jelly in there of some sort, and somehow these things are able to make copies of themselves and such. But as more and more work has been done in microbiology, biology on the small scale, and in molecular chemistry and such, it's become apparent that life is very, very complicated. Carl Sagan wrote the article in the last couple editions of Encyclopedia Britannica, which is entitled Life, the article on life, Encyclopedia Britannica. And using a little computer jargon, he says that that the information content of the simplest living cell is equal to, let's see, forgotten what the number is now that I got in the middle of this a remark and not my notes, so we'll have to convert it into what he converts it into. He says the information content in the simplest living cell is equivalent to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And if you convert that into volumes, the Encyclopedia Britannica would be about 4,000 sets. So information stored in the simplest living cell for how to make its own parts, how to run its various procedures and such, is equivalent to about 4,000 sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. As people have been then trying to figure out how life might have arisen by chance, they've come upon the problem that we don't know of any natural processes that will make anything like that much order out of random phenomena. No way to do that. I don't know how much Sagan has been influenced in that direction. I've not seen him comment on that. Last I heard, he was very much into the idea that, yes, life has arisen by some very, perhaps very rare chemical events that have taken place in history. But a friend of his, a very well-known cosmologist, Fred Hoyle, who was certainly an atheist when I was doing my doctoral work in the 60s, has tried to work out mathematical computations of the likelihood of producing life from non-life, and he's come to the conclusion that there's no chance, he's got a number like 10 to the minus 100th chance, that anywhere in the universe in its whole history, life would have formed by chance. And so he has come to conclude, and this occurs in his book called Evolution from Space, that indeed there must be a designer out there, maybe a finite designer, but some being that was able to put together living things. And so, rather interestingly then, Hoyle has moved from an atheistic to some kind of a theistic position since the mid-60s, in the last 20 years. He has moved rather substantially. He's no Christian, as far as I know, but has moved a considerable distance. And he's done it by not looking at the Bible, but by looking at the universe. Another thing that's cropped up it's been around since the Bridgewater treatises back in the last century, but really little was done with it after the rise of Darwinism, was the evidence that there was some design in inanimate nature. That it's not just all the design in living things. And of course, the design in living things, you could argue with a little hand-waving, was maybe due to mutation and natural selection and such. But what about design in inanimate things? So books were being written now and then. There's a book from the early part of the century called The Fitness of the Environment that discusses why the environment seems to fit so nicely with living things, to which most evolutionists would have answered, why, the life evolved to fit that environment. But study of, particularly, of the basic forces in the universe and the behavior of the universe as a whole has led to the realization that there are a number of features that if you change them very slightly, life couldn't exist. That the universe is very finely tuned balance between how fast it's expanding and how strong the force is pulling it back together. And one author, this fellow is Paul Davies, in his book Accidental Universe, has concluded that looking at the balance between the expansion of the universe and gravity pulling it back together, looking at the balance between the electromagnetic force and gravitational force, looking at the relationship between the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force, and both of them related how they relate to electromagnetic force and such. He's looking at these four basic forces in the universe, the expansion of the universe, several other things. He's concluded that there's almost no chance that if you made a universe randomly, it would have the right numbers to have life in it. And when he wrote his book, The Accidental Universe, his conclusion at that time was, well, the universe looks designed, but that's just because if it weren't this well fit together, we wouldn't be here to look at it. There might be trillions of other universes, but they're not fitted together well enough to have any life in them. And if they don't have any life in them, don't even intelligent life in them. And if there's no intelligent life in them, then you can't look out at the universe and see what it's like. There's no you to look out there. That's called the weak anthropic principle, and we're not going to wander off into that. Rather interesting, just ran across a book in the last month by Paul Davies called Superforce, in which he concludes in the last sentence that the universe, even if you could explain all the forces of the universe as one force, which is kind of the big thing that theoretical physicists are trying to do right now, you'd still have to explain why that one force does all the complicated, beautifully fit together things it does to produce life and other things of that sort. He says it still looks like you've got a designed universe. And so it looks like Davies, in the last 5 years that I've been reading him, has moved from an atheist to some kind of a theist in that period as well. Our last example is even more unbelievable, and that's Carl Sagan. Most of you have probably heard or seen or something his TV series, book Cosmos, etc., where he obviously came down very strongly in that book the cosmos is all that ever that is or ever was or ever will be. Strong theological statement from a theology in which there's no God. And yet he has moved, probably on the basis of this design in the inanimate universe, to some kind of a universe in which there's a God. I wouldn't call him a theist, I'd call him a deist, a person who believes there's a designer God who doesn't meddle with the universe. That'd be my guess. You can find that in a novel he just wrote called Contact, which the hero, a woman, Roman astrophysicist, comes to learn, yes, there are intelligent beings out there in the universe, etc. And then eventually you get on further in the book, and she finds out that there's design in the number pi. And I'm not going to get into that. That's obviously guesswork of Sagan's, etc. But this person who becomes some kind of a deist is so favorably treated in the book, it's hard to believe that Sagan himself has not moved to that particular position by the time he got this book put together. All of that to say, it is pretty widely recognized now by persons who don't consider themselves biblical theists at all, that there's some strong evidence out there that's extremely hard to explain from the perspective of a universe with no designer, with no beginner, etc. The universe gives every evidence of being designed. We shouldn't be surprised that God, having told us these things in Romans 1, might very well have hidden a few surprises of that sort in his universe, which as technology advances, they would come to knowledge, because persons who want to explain away God spend generations figuring out how to explain away each of these things as they turn up. And at the moment, it looks like the momentum is picking up in the direction of pressing people in the direction of God. Where we will go, I do not claim to have any definite insight, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some form of secular humanism and atheism perhaps wither down somewhat in the coming generations. That can be encouraging and, of course, discouraging as well, because you're aware that the activities of the Antichrist at the end of the age will certainly not be atheistic. They will be some kind of theism in which the Antichrist is supposed to be worshipped. But we'll have to wait and see how all that comes out. Okay, so that's our discussion of evidence from cosmos. We're moving on then to evidence for God from the conscience. And it appears that Paul begins to move into this perhaps as early as verse 21, but there's sort of a transition passage in here which I list as Romans 1, 21 through 32. Some consequences which God allows to happen, causes to happen, plans to happen, we not hold all the ins and outs of that, for man turning away from this evidence which he has got already. And yet we'll suggest that what happens to them as they turn away is in fact evidence for God in the universe. And we can perhaps put it under evidence from conscience, although I'm not sure that's the best thing to call this section. Certainly the three passages here, 132, 21, and 214 through 15, are evidence from conscience. I'm going to back up verse 18 to read in a little context here. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven upon all the impiety and unrighteousness of mankind, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is plainly to be seen among them, in them. For God has revealed it to them, for the invisible things about him are perceived from the creation of the world, being understood by the things that are made, namely his eternal power and divine nature, so that they are without excuse. Because, having known God, they did not glorify him as God, nor thank him, but became foolish in their reasonings, and their senseless hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise men, they became foolish, and they changed the glory of the immortal God into the likeness of the image of mortal men, and beasts, and birds, and beasts, and snakes. What you see here is man not willing to declare about God what's true of him, to remind others of his distinctive nature, not being thankful to God for what they received. They begin to have to explain away God. They begin to explain away God, and God lets them go. God allows them to reap the consequences of this turning away from him. And the first consequences seem to be theoretical consequences. Theoretical consequence: if God doesn't exist, then the God who exists is viewed as not existing, then what are you going to have as an alternative? And he lists some of the alternatives that were around at New Testament times. Making God into the immortal God into the likeness of the image of mortal men and birds and beasts and snakes. We might think of the Greek religion as making God to be like mortal mankind. They believed in the immortality of the gods, by the way, but the shenanigans that the gods and goddesses were involved in were very much the sort of thing that mankind is involved in. And so what they were doing exactly what the atheists claim all people do, that is, they were making God in their own image. But God rebukes them for doing that. He says, no, you're made in my image, not the other way around. You can't make God any way you want to. Going down to the birds and beasts and snakes, he picks up more of the Egyptian form of religion, which was known and somewhat ridiculed at New Testament times by the persons who felt themselves to be more sophisticated in this whole area. This is the direction that you go off into. Although that's particularly about ancient Greek and Egyptian and other sorts of religions, there's really some sense, if you like, in which something like evolution, in a sense, is doing this sort of thing, and saying the highest version of life that now exists is mankind. Or looking at the beasts or birds or snakes or something of that sort as our ancestors and our makers in that vague sort of sense. I don't want to press that. I don't think Paul had that in mind. God may have been giving us a few hints in that direction, but let's not go any further in that direction. When one rejects the God who exists, there's a tendency to replace God by man or even by the lesser animals. There's a tendency to move into a polytheism, which is very much molded on human society, or to move into an animism in which various animals have particular significance, or in which even plants and trees and rocks and such have are thought to have spirits behind them. And yet there's not only this theoretical shift, which comes from rejecting God, but there's also some very practical things that happen as well. By the way, in using the term theoretical and practical here, I do not mean that the theology of polytheism and animism aren't very practical. They're very practical. Almost everything that people are doing in universities in theoretical areas are practical in the sense that they come to have practical consequences. And so that's the case as well here. And the reason why society is so different in India and Africa and those other places has an awful lot to do with the theory that lies behind those societies for what life is all about, what man is all about. And it really makes a difference. But we'll still use the term theoretical and practical for this in this rather sloppy sort of way. The next thing which Paul moves on to is the abandonment of the created form of sex for perverted forms. Therefore, God handed them over in the lusts of their hearts to uncleanness so as to dishonor their bodies among themselves. They who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and who worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Therefore, God handed them over to dishonorable lusts, their females exchanging the natural relations for those contrary to nature. Likewise, also, the males, abandoning natural relations with females, were influenced with desire for one another, male with male working shameless deeds and receiving the penalty in themselves, which is fitting for their error. Notice that. Marital sex moves to free sex, to homosexuality. Nothing here about bestiality, but mentioned enough as a crime worthy of death in the Old Testament that certainly existed. No question about that. And notice the remark there, and receiving the penalty in themselves, which is fitting for their error. You certainly going to find a lot of people in our society don't want to hear about it, but the biblical statement is that herpes and AIDS and gonorrhea and syphilis, etc., are God's response to man's going his own way. And we don't need to get into a long discussion of exactly how God chose to do it that way. I don't know the answer to that, but this remark seems to point rather strongly in that particular direction. God is basically allowing man to see, and this may even be an argument from collective conscience, the consequences of abandoning him in theology, the consequences of abandoning his regulations regarding sex, they work out in society. And eventually they make such a mess of the place that you don't want to live there anymore. You want to go somewhere else if you know about any better place to go. And so we begin to see some evidence here from conscience. That's why I put that under that particular one. And lastly, I give you a heading here under this sort of a transition section, the abandonment of created morality for perverted morality. And just as they, verse 28, just as they did not approve of having God in their knowledge, God handed them over to a disapproved mind to do what is not fitting, being filled with all sorts of unrighteousness, unwickedness, covetousness, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, talebearers, slanderers, haters of God, violent, arrogant, braggarts, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, loveless, merciless, those who know the commandment of God, that they who do such things are worthy of death, not only do these things, but also approve of those who do such. God's picture here is not only when you abandon theology do you get into rather stupid things like worshiping snails and such eventually. Not only when you abandon God's sexuality standards do you get into things that obviously have no profit and mess people up quite thoroughly. But when you abandon God's standards of morality, all this immorality begins to pour in and begins to happen. And this was going on in the first century A.D., but it's going on in the 20th century A.D., as well. And in a sense, it's almost cycled over again because it was only in the last century that the idea that atheism might really be a valid explanation of the world caught on. And we are seeing in our own century what happens when atheism is adopted widely. Namely, one cannot justify moral standards. One cannot justify sex standards. But if you don't have them, things start to fall apart. And the Russians are having considerable problems in that area. That things are falling apart, and so in several places, they've just had a decree, you can't do this. But they've got a basis for it, except you do this and we'll shoot you, or put you in jail or something like that. A fellow commented to me recently, he was from another country, there's something strange in your country. People seem to naturally obey the law. And the picture seemed to be that in the society he came from, law was something that coerced people to do things and not something a person tried to internalize, etc. I don't know that our country is all that great, but apparently there were some remnants of Christian influence that he had seen. He happened to have had some contact with a Christian family through ISI. I think that probably had something to do with it. But he could notice a difference in that whole area. I suggest that already this material, but then as we go on further in this, the last verse of this chapter and in the verses of the next chapter, we have a situation that is somewhat parallel to what was said about evidence from cosmos. And so I've tried to construct it parallel. If you'll sit, the way you can't do this because you've got your stuff printed on the back of the same page, but I've got the front and the back right here beside me. Certain of God's invisible attributes are visible in the conscience, just as certain of God's invisible attributes are visible, so to speak, in the cosmos. And this will be developed then as we go on beyond this passage. Verse 32, those who know and the commandment of God or recognize the commandment of God, that those who do such things are worthy of death, not only do these things, but also approve of those who do. Notice Paul is assuming, and he's certainly right about this, that there are people out there who recognize that people who do this whole list of wicked things listed up here, there really ought to be something done about them. They really ought to get what's coming to them, etc. That, in fact, is a very, very common idea. In fact, you'll probably find it fairly hard to locate people who don't really believe that. Now, there are a lot of people who will say, well, there shouldn't be capital punishment, but they'll get mad enough to kill somebody sometime if the person does the wrong things to them. That is, although they've got a certain theory about how man is and how morality is and that sort of thing, when you come down to the nitty-gritty, they actually have a little better standards than they come across with, because they do recognize something about the persons deserving certain things. And it shows up in their anger. I will say a word or two about that further down here in the talk. We need to press on. We're about out of time. In verse 1, we carry on the same idea. Notice it says, therefore, following from verse 32, therefore, O man, the word there also allows women to be included, you are without excuse, every one of you who judges, for in that which you judge the other person, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. A denial of the existence of moral standards, because there's no God to make them absolute standards, but the persons actually use the standards. They use the standards not to judge themselves, that's rare enough, to judge others. They're suppressing the truth in unrighteousness because they're using moral standards on others that they won't use on themselves. That seems to be the picture that we have here. And Paul turns in that particular direction. We will not have time to exegete this whole passage, but ask you to come down with me to verses 14 and 15. For whenever Gentiles, not having the law, you remember this whole passage is about those without the Bible, the evidence of general revelation. Whenever Gentiles, not having the law, do by nature or instinct or do naturally the things of the law, they, not having the law, are a law for themselves, who demonstrate the work of the law written in their hearts, their consciences also bearing testimony and support. Meanwhile, their reasonings are accusing or even defending each other. That ends a parenthesis there, on the day when God, etc., picks up from earlier on. What's going on here? Paul is saying something about there's a law written in the heart. Now, you know there's some uses of that in the Bible, which refer to regeneration, which refer to the new covenant, etc. But this is something else. This is something that applies to people that haven't even heard of the Bible. But there's something written inside. My suggestion is, here, Paul is picking up one of the things that has been made, namely the human conscience, which has been made by God, and says, we may learn something about God's invisible attributes by this one thing that has been made, the human conscience. And what we learn from there is not God's eternal power, particularly, and not perhaps some features of his deity that have to do with his design or something like that. We learn rather, as I suggest up here, something about his righteousness, because we've got righteous standards put in us. Something about his impartiality. Don't think that if you're going to judge all these other people and say, they deserve this and this and this, but you do the same thing, that you're going to get away with that. You know how that looks when you see other people doing it, don't you? So why should you suppose when God sees you doing it, he's going to make a special case of you? So we learn something about God's righteousness, impartiality, justice actually is kind of closely related to those two. And we see obviously some hints that these things are understood well enough to judge others. Understood well enough to judge others. And therefore the person is without excuse. Notice how it comes in verse 1, 2-1. Therefore, O man, you are without excuse. So just as our previous section on conscience has ended being understood by the things that are made, namely his eternal power and divine nature, so that they are without excuse, therefore you are without excuse. This is not just a question that we can leave up to the cosmologists and physicists and chemists and biologists. It comes home in conscience. We have evidence in conscience. We don't have to know anything about cosmology, etc. There's evidence of something planted in man that leaves us without excuse. What is this thing that's planted in man? Well, we got a name for it, conscience, which is derived from Latin and means to see with, and that was apparently derived from Greek, which means to see with, sunatesis. And it sort of has the idea of we're seeing something alongside the way God looks or something. It probably means getting God's perspective on something. We don't have it all worked out, and I'm not sure anybody knows today exactly what it is. But there's some kind of standards inside man, we don't know exactly how they get there, that point to God's righteous judgment. there have been desire to explain the way, just like there's a desire to explain the way a universe that looks like it's got design, or a universe that's got, looks like it's got a beginning. But the alternatives have never been able to come up with an explanation of, one, why basic moral principles are universal. If they're evolved in the human nature, why are they the same? They're not identical, of course. Why are they so similar in drastically different cultures, as indeed they are? I sketch for you a list of some of these moral standards in the back of C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, a rather nice discussion of standards and the need for standards in society and how persons are, how educators are often trying to destroy standards and what a mess they're likely to make, and then evidence that such standards do exist and that you can't derive them from anything else. That's the point that Lewis makes. Moral standards can't be derived from aesthetics, they can't be derived from logic, and they can't be derived from just looking at the universe. Physics doesn't have any moral standards. You don't get moral standards out of physics, out of math, out of chemistry, etc. There's evidence of design. Moral standards seem to be some whole separate category, kind of like logic and aesthetics. There's some kind of standard sitting there of some sort. You can't prove them from something else. I think this is probably why the Dutch philosopher Herman Duyverd wanted to make a bunch of different spheres of reality, and one of them was this whole area of ethics, as well as the others. And maybe that's where it is at the moment. I don't really know. I don't understand Duyverd, by the way, either, so I'm not going to carry you off in that direction. I give you some suggestions down here of how these things are revealed, perceived, and although I say we're not told, that's really not strictly true. I think the material in Romans 1, 21 through 32 sketch what happens when you try to deny there's any God behind the conscience. Society starts to fall apart. Whereas when you recognize it and live like it, society works rather well, that you can actually see that. And I think the same thing happens on an individual level. When you deny there's a God, when you deny there's any standards, your life begins to fall apart. Whereas as far as this life is concerned, if you really live by absolute standards, things will go fairly well for you. That's not to say that you might not have lots of disasters happen. But other things being equal, things will go rather well for you. Employers will be more likely to hire you than if you live like there are no standards, etc. So I suggest here two different kinds of arguments that have been developed. One of them I call a collective conscience argument. That's not to say that there's some kind of collective conscience out there floating around, but the evidence of conscience on a collective scale. I have not done a lot of reading in this area. Two works I have read that I thought had been helpful. An old work by Samuel Zwemer. I'm not a Pennsylvania Dutch. There's a better pronunciation than that. Zwemer we'll go with, okay. The Origin of Religion. Basically discussing the fact that religion is universal, that moral standards are universal, and that religion does not look like it evolved. Evolutionary origin of religion was a very great idea in the last century after Darwin. It's come over into our century, but it predicts that animism gives rise to polytheism, gives rise to henotheism, gives rise to monotheism, gives rise to atheism, etc. But in fact, when you actually look in societies and history, you find many, many animist societies that believe there is one unique, eternal creator God, a high God, that they've lost contact with somehow, and they got to work with the lower echelons and such. And that's developed by Zwemer some years ago in The Origin of Religion, and more recently by Don Richardson, a evangelical who's a missionary theologian, we might call him, in his work Eternity in Their Hearts. Run on very quickly to an area which I consider myself even less competent in, the individual conscience argument. The best discussion of that I've seen so far is in C.S. Lewis's work, Mere Christianity. The first section of that work is called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. And I recommend you read it because you'll get more out of it reading it than I will trying to explain it. he basically does some of the things I've said a word or two about, that conscience is universal, that you can't explain it as just logic, you can't explain it as just personal preference, and you can't derive ought statements, you ought to do this or that, from is statements. Things are this way because you've got to get back to some standard behind it. Why ought we to do that, etc.? One last remark, a little article by Kenneth Pike that occurred in the Journal of American Scientific Affiliation a few years ago. He suggests one new idea I had not seen much about. Anger is a good way of testing what a person's moral standards really are. What do they get angry about when they're done to them? That is a measure of the moral standards they think ought to be followed, whether they follow them themselves or not. None of us do very well, you realize that. But what makes you angry is something that calibrates what kind of conscience you've really got. Even though you may verbally deny that there are any moral standards, the way you naturally react is a measure of the ones you've got. I'd like to suggest here then that the Lord, through Apostle Paul, has laid out for us here that men are responsible for believing in God and doing something about it. We, by the way, are responsible for helping them to see that the various refuges they have are not good refuges, that they do involve them in suppressing the truth, and in trying to help them to see that there is a God and doing something about it before they mess up their own lives, or the lives of their children, or the whole life of their nation. I'm reminded in closing of Dr. Benjamin Spock, not to be confused with a fellow on Star Trek, who helped us raise a whole generation or two of children in his books on child psychology and such, child training, who admitted just a few years ago he'd really been wrong about some important things all that time. But the damage had already been done. There are two ways in which you can learn about God. One of them is find out the hard way, by messing things up and recognizing after you've ruined your life, or maybe even worse, at the judgment, that there is a God after all and you should have taken his advice. Or by really trying to find out whether there is a God and looking at the evidence, and God says, if you do that, you'll find that there is, and then straightening your life out before you really make a complete wreck of the whole place. Let's pray.